Let's make it happen, Captain.
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag. And Gov doesn't want to talk this morning. He's tired. He just wants to get right into the questions.
So no, what I want to do is sleep.
Yeah. All right. So from Chris, he says, ironically, I had just last week replaced a laptop with a Surface Pro. Nice. And had been prepared to go through all my Wi-Fi connections and re-enter passwords that I connect to. I was pleasantly surprised when I logged into the Surface at home and entered the passwords that connect, and went to enter the passwords that connected right away. And then I took it to work, preparing to enter the passwords for access there, and found that it was already authenticated. The same was true with the rest of the networks. I'm not sure if this would be due to having set up my Windows 8 devices to log in with my live sign-in, or if something else is in play there. A little more research showed me that several other configuration items that are native to Windows 8 Pro also had settings sync between the two systems. So just a thought. Like everyone says, I love the show. Of course. But yeah, this is one of the benefits to having a logon that
this
you can
Windows
tie
8.
To your account.
Yeah, so this is the connected accounts feature for Windows 8.
I didn't even know it did this, to be perfectly honest.
It's super cool. Like, and yes, you log in with your Live ID or your Microsoft account, as it's called now. It's been called so many different things over the years. And, you know, the cool thing is that it doesn't even have to be like a Hotmail account or a Live.com account or an Outlook.com account. It can be any email address that you have.
Yeah.
You just have to, I call it promotion to a Microsoft account.
Yeah.
And as long as you sign into that into all of your various computers, then various settings like your Wi-Fi passwords are just going to roam with you, along with various store apps may have their settings synced to the cloud and then roam with you if you have those same apps installed.
Yeah, and I knew that it would do this. Here, let me mute my machine. I knew that it would do this for some things, but I didn't know what all was included in that. So I guess that would be a good action item for me to take, is to figure out what are all the different settings that that roam with you on that.
So one thing to realize is that not all settings will necessarily roam all the time. Mm-hmm. We do have heuristics that will dictate of whether or not things should be roaming, or things should be syncing, I should say, especially if you're on a metered connection.
Yeah.
You know, certain things just won't download or upload when you're on a metered connection.
Cool. Okay. All right. From Timothy, is there a way to keep the PSR settings? I hope to find a way to keep the number of recent screen captures to store set to 100. Also, who do I need to talk to with the few enhancements to PSR? First, the ability to increase number of recent screen captures stored to 500 or 1,000. Second, the ability to pick the screen to record when multiple monitors are involved. Third, defining level of key capture, all non-hidden or none. Yeah, I mean, you can put those here. There's people from the Windows team that watch the show. I'm happy to forward on an email as well.
Actually,
I don't know of another way.
PSR is owned by my team.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
there you go.
But the thing is that, yes, we've heard these requests before, and unfortunately, it's kind of like a ranking issue, right? Like, what things do we need to actually work on?
Yeah.
What are higher priority issues? So these aren't, unfortunately, new asks, but they are not at the point in the list where we can actually address them.
Yeah.
So PSR, for those that don't know, is a super handy tool for recording steps. They call it it's just the steps recorder.
Yeah, problem steps recorder.
Yes, it's called PSR, but it is now just the steps recorder because it's not strictly designed for problems.
All right.
Or it's been co-opted for use for other uses.
Yeah.
Now, the settings that you're talking about are in here, and this number of recent screen captures store is 25, and you can up it to 100. If you actually check the help for this, and you scroll all the way to the bottom, and you adjust settings, it will tell you the fact that when you adjust the settings, they're only safe for your current session. After you close and reopen, it will return to the default settings.
Yeah.
So, in fact, no, there isn't a way. These are
hard coded. So it's by design.
This is by design that the settings aren't stored. As for the various feature enhancements, requests, you know, all we can say is that if enough people ask for them, then, you know, the request can get bumped up.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, send in your requests. and we'll see what we can do. But, I mean, I can't guarantee anything.
Yeah.
Lord knows we have a bunch of things that we're working on. And the steps recorder, unfortunately, is not our highest priority item.
Yeah. But it sounds like you came to the right place. All right. From Guyan, who from an earlier show, you might remember, deleted most of the important fonts on his system, which caused some problems specifically with the start screen. Says, it seems that Windows keeps a backup of all the default fonts in the C Windows WinSXS, which is Windows side-by-side folder. Just go to the directory and search for the font. Type Calibri to obtain the Calibri TTF font. Copy and paste in the Windows font directory, and voila.
Now, it's not technically a backup.
Yeah.
So the side-by-side directory is the overall repository of all the various features that could potentially be installed on the OS. This is why, I don't know if you remember this from back in the 9X and even XP days.
Yeah.
If there's a feature that you didn't install, you'd have to go and hunt for the CD, plug it in when you wanted to enable it in the add or remove Windows components.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to do that anymore because basically the entire installation is copied down to your system when you install Windows.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons for the SXX folder, the side-by-side folder, is that it has various components that aren't necessarily turned on and maybe hard-linked. So the features could be enabled via hard-linking to the side-by-side folder. Now, for the fonts, those were specifically copied over from the side-by-side into the Windows font directory, and then when it was deleted, you had a backup copy in the side-by-side folder.
But they were there.
But they're there. Well, they could be there.
They could be there.
I mean, it's not something that's guaranteed to be there, depending on how the fonts were deleted. If you had a rogue uninstallation program that actually deleted the fonts and you didn't do it manually, it could have gone in and whacked the files in the side-by-side folder. So it's not something that you can necessarily count on.
Cool. Okay. All right. And he also says, ever since watching your shows, I love having problems on Windows and solving them. You learn a lot of invaluable knowledge about Windows systems. That is correct. And that's, I think for some people who do tech support, they kind of like it. They secretly like the problems because they like trying to solve.
Problem solving is fun.
Issues. Yeah, it is. All right. This one was from Reddit, the subreddit 24-hour support, which I was interested to find. There's actually a makes sense. There's a subreddit for everything. There is one for 24-hour tech support. And this one was solved, but I'd seen it before, so I wanted to talk about it anyway. But he says, I right-clicked on a picture for set as desktop background, which worked, but now the button, which I don't think is a button, is probably the contextual menu, is just floating on my screen and won't go away. A restart will probably fix it, but I want to know if there's another fix to it. I tried repeating the action in the hopes that it might take the button away, but it didn't work. The button itself doesn't do anything when I click on it. It's just like the image of it is floating there. I have seen that before.
You've seen it before.
Mm-hmm. First of all, what is that?
It's just a visual artifact from the compositor, DWM.
Yeah.
What you can do, I mean, there's a few different ways of solving if you don't want to reboot. You can log off and log back on.
Mm-hmm.
You can kill Explorer and then restart Explorer.
That's what I typically do.
That's what you typically do. I think that's what most people typically does. And, you know, for those of you that aren't aware, when you have a hung Explorer or just an Explorer that's acting erratically, you can go Control Shift Escape to start up a task manager, or you know, right click
on the task bar.
There.
Do task manager.
And you can kill your Explorer process from the details tab. I've got something set up right now. I'm not going to kill it right away. And then you can run a new task.
Just do Explorer.exe.
And just run Explorer.exe. And task manager will start it. Whatever you do, don't click on the create this task with admin privileges, because that will run Explorer elevated, and then lots of interesting things could potentially happen.
Okay.
If you do it on Windows 8, Explorer run elevated, your start menu won't work, store apps won't work, blah, blah, blah. It's a whole mess if you try to run Explorer elevated.
Okay. Couple other things I've done in the past to get rid of this. I'm thinking even back to Vista, I've seen this before. Sometimes you drag your mouse.
Primarily in Vista.
Yeah, sometimes you drag your mouse around it. That'll make it go away. Sometimes I'll use like the snipping tool. Mm. And for some reason, that seems to, I think that's made it go away before too. And then ultimately, you know, you can kill Explorer.exe. You can log out and log back in, or just reboot. So I've done all those things.
One thing to consider is upgrading your video drivers.
Yeah.
Because there is this very tight relationship between the modules loaded in Explorer for your video drivers, the kernel mode drivers themselves. If they're not perfectly matched or they're not up to date, or if you have the kernel mode that has been updated for whatever reason, but the user mode processes or user mode DLLs have not, they can cause some erratic issues like this.
Okay, cool. All right, next question. Printers added by other administrators on the same machine cannot have its properties or permissions changed by administrator other than the one who created it. The administrator's group does have the managed printer's permission. Is that behavior normal? How can I work around it? Here's a step-by-step to reproduce a problem. Add a new printer, create another administrator user. Let's call it temp admin. Log in as temp admin. Open the printer properties and try to change the port the printer is installed on. In my case, they are disabled.
So what you want to make sure that you're doing is when you're going to the printer properties on the general page.
You could just click ports up there, which what they might be doing here.
If you click ports, you'll see, yes, it is disabled. If you go to the general page and you choose change properties, this will get you an elevated context, which then should allow you to change the ports.
Interesting.
It's a little bit convoluted to manage printers that have been installed by other users.
Yeah, okay. All right, next question. I have two storage drives. One's a hard drive and the other is an SSD. I used to run Windows on the hard drive and left the SSD untouched, but then I installed another Windows copy on the SSD, which has the E drive letter. The drives are currently C, which has the old OS, and E, which has the new OS. I'd like to make the new OS on the SSD the primary drive, therefore having the C letter instead. I tried switching the old C to H, and then switch E to C, but it said invalid parameter. Do you have any idea how to do this? I really don't want to reinstall again, if possible. So, yeah, we both kind of looked at that, and a little cringe, maybe. That's not the best way to have things set up.
I've seen it before. One thing you can do is either deal with the fact that drive letter is E.
Yeah.
But you're not going to be changing the system drive letter from E to C.
It'd be an OCD thing for me. I'd flip out knowing that my system drive was on E.
Really? Why?
I don't know. It should just be a mental thing. I just always expect it to be in C. And I think every time I open Windows Explorer, I don't know, my skin would crawl.
Hmm.
I wouldn't be able to take it. So what you'd need to do, he needs to flatten.
So then how do you handle multi-booted systems?
I don't have any multi-booted systems.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. That
we all don't live like Go.
I mean, I've got, systems that boot off VHDs that have, numerous different drive letters.
The closest and only thing that I have like that is I have a Windows to Go USB drive that I might plug in and boot off that.
But that should be labeled as C as well, because it'll actually not read from the built-in drive when you
exactly.
boot up a Windows to Go drive.
Yeah.
Small sidebar on Windows to Go. Which, unfortunately, you can only use if you have Enterprise Edition.
And you can only use if you use the right USB drive.
Specs for the Windows to Go drive are relatively high. It's the type of flash memory that's used in it.
They are tight parameters, and I was only able to find a couple different drives.
They're relatively expensive.
Yeah. They seem to be bigger, too, for some reason.
Yeah, 64 gig drives is probably...
No, I mean physically bigger.
Yes. They tend to be physically bigger.
I don't know why that is.
The different type of flash that's used.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So what would you suggest here? You just need to repave...
Or learn to live with it.
Yeah.
But the problem is that you're not going to be able to rename the system drive where it's had its path set up all throughout the registry.
Let's say you were able to do that. Would you still have a stable system then?
I don't think you'd boot.
Yeah. Because, there's a lot of different pointers and things that it just seems problematic.
Seems very problematic.
I wouldn't even do it. I mean, it seems like especially if you're installing the SSD, this is going to be a pretty quick process.
Yeah, and, I know I've seen steps on the internet on how to change your drive letter. I'm sure people are going to comment on, there's these steps and these steps that are able to do it. And you probably could, but depending on how the paths are encoded in the registry, what applications you might have installed afterwards, how they've saved the paths, INI files that are saved off, this is not going to be a good time.
So I'll tell you how I would fix this, and you can tell me if it's just a big mess or not. But I would just copy anything important on the SSD to the hard drive. Take the hard drive out.
Mm-hmm.
Flatten the machine with the SSD as the C drive. Get it all going like you want it. Stick the other hard drive back in.
Mm-hmm.
I'd probably use that as where I install all my applications, or most of them for the most part.
That's exactly how I'd do it.
Yeah, so there you go. That's what I'd do. Next question. I want to use more desktops. I'm running Windows 7 Home Premium, so I'm searching for a lightweight program giving me more space for my icons on the desktop, like for video editing, one for games, one for programming, and so on, because they don't fit on a single desktop, I assume they mean. All should be at a single monitor. Do you know of such a tool? Well, I can think of a couple things. Desktops, too, would be one choice that you could do, which will give you different desktops. You could have a desktop for gaming, a desktop for programming, and just kind of allow you to pivot environments
mm-hmm.
into a different section. That's one way. The other way, which is what I actually do, is I use Stardock Fences, which is a cool little utility that'll let you right-click and drag around a group of icons on your desktop. And when you do that, it says, hey, what do you want to call these? And you give it a name, and it creates kind of a folder that lives on the desktop.
Mm-hmm.
The nice thing about it, though, is if you have too many icons in it, you can just scroll up and down. The really nice thing about it, though, is double-clicking on the background in the desktop will just get rid of everything. It does the view icons on the desktop thing. It toggles that to turn off. So I would use Fences. Desktops, too, might be a good solution.
And me, because
both free.
I'm seriously low-tech when it comes to that. And as
you can tell, put folders on the desktop.
I would put folders on the desktop, but frankly, I don't have icons on my desktop.
Yeah.
So, but yes, if I needed to do that, I'd just stick folders on the desktop that actually has the icons that I need. I mean, otherwise, I pin it to the taskbar. I have it in the start screen. I'm, frankly, I don't look at the desktop. I mean, look at this thing.
Yeah.
This is the desktop that I've got because I've been too lazy to want to change it from this because I don't care about it.
So one thing that I used to do back in the day, I mean, I would put folders on my desktop like that, but then I'd go into the properties and change the folder icons to some pings that I had to make it look a little fancy. Because, you know, I'm all about the eye candy.
Mm-hmm.
So I would do that, but I just really like Fences now. So I just, every time I install, you know, an OS, I stick that on the system usually. So, all right. A couple different options for you there. Next question. I have a network drive mapped to Z. Is there
Z, whatever.
Is there a simple command to know the full network path from CMD? If CMD shows Z:\ABC, I'd like a command to output the network drive map directory /ABC. Netuse is fine, but I'd like to get the full path of the current working directory for quick copies.
There's nothing in box to do it, but we actually have a KB article on getting the UNC path from a map drive with some VB. It's an older article, and you can convert this to PowerShell if you wanted to. And then save it as a command line tool.
Yeah.
But here's the overriding code involved in order to get that.
So simple. Grandma will be throwing that in.
Well, Grandma's not using a command line.
No, that's true. All right.
This is KB192689. You know, for those of you that wanted to tear this apart and create a PowerShell script from it if you wanted to, you know, convert it to the 20th century.
Okay.
21st All right. century.
All right. Next question. With hard drives, you know you're being thrashed because you can hear it, but what about silent SSDs with no movable parts? I can't help but wonder what sneaky tricks developers will hide in their applications once SSDs become more common. After the prices go down, for instance, applications will be able to access your drive virtually all they want because you'll never know what's happening. Therefore, it only seems plausible that some sort of drive access monitoring tool will exist to let you know when you're being thrashed. It could even prompt you and allow you to allow hard drive read-write permissions whenever a particular process attempts to access your drive. Does something like this already exist? All right, there's a bunch of things there. One, I think you're assuming too much about what a developer might do. Ain't nobody got time for that, to be thrashing your drive for no reason. And if your drive is thrashing from an application, it's probably doing something. Doesn't mean it's doing something the right way. but it's probably got a purpose there. Like you were saying, games will sometimes use a lot of...
Yeah, I mean, games are my number one go-to for anything that is going to be potentially hitting the disk a lot.
Yeah.
But most applications aren't going to be hitting the disk a lot, and you kind of have to trust the apps that you're installing.
Yeah.
To actually talk about how to know if your disk, like just from the technical perspective of is your disk being accessed too frequently? You know, low-tech method is just Task Manager.
Yeah.
So you're on Task Manager, and there's a few different ways of doing this. You can go to Performance tab, and you can check out your disk. You can open Resource Monitor.
100%, you're being thrashed right now.
Well, probably. IE's probably doing it. But if you go to Details...
Pointing out that you use a netbook, about the lowest rung on the evolutionary ladder there.
That's true.
So...
There's some columns that you can add to Task Manager that will actually help you understand what is hitting, which particular process is hitting your disk.
Yeah.
Page faults are a good one, but all of the IOs are going to be, you know, your best bet on figuring out which process is using the disk the most. So if you're looking at, like, IO reads, you know, I currently have WinDBG running, and it's having the highest number of I/O reads, and oddly enough, I/O writes. So, next one is service host. You can figure out of the processes here which one is going to be hitting your disk the
most.
So,
how would you even define thrashing? I mean, is that something that even comes from... I mean, I wouldn't call, like, a game doing lots of reads.
Well, it's paging, right? So any kind of disk access.
Yeah.
If you're either pulling stuff from disk into memory, or if you're dumping from memory to disk.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to cause thrashing in the rotational disk sense. For SSDs, of course, you're not going to hear it. And the big problem with thrashing is... why people hear it most is because on the old drives, the heads were just going all around the drive.
Yeah.
Right? So one of the older ways to reduce the thrashing that you would hear is by defragmenting your drive.
Yeah.
And all that did was put the stuff that was probably being read to and read from most frequently by a process all in one location, so it wouldn't have to travel the disk as far.
Yeah.
But again, with an SSD, you don't hear that because... It doesn't matter where on the disk, because it's not really...
There's no read head.
There's no read head there.
Yeah.
So, going back to, like, the whole giving permission to a process before it is able to read and write, technically speaking, you could do it, but to have that type of monitoring process would really get in the way.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure some anti-malware apps... could do that. I'm sure some bunch of auditing apps could do that, but that
sounds like a bad time to me.
Yeah, it would be very intrusive. I mean, if you truly did care about stuff like that, about what was accessing, you could turn on auditing on the file system to see what's accessing, you know, particular files. If you are worried about an app that is accessing private data, for example. Or you could, you know, not put that data on the disk, put it on a thumb drive, and that way it's not there for anybody to access except when you're accessing it. Again, if you're super paranoid, you know, don't run anything, don't create an admin user, you know, create a standard user and just log into that, and that way, you know, nothing can elevate.
Yeah.
And install its hooks into the rest of the system.
Okay. Well, it's a good thing neither of us are super paranoid. All right, pick of the week time, pick of the week. And so this is about a robot that can look and determine when it thinks you need a beer and actually go get a beer for you. Not just go get a beer. That's 20th century stuff right there. You can train a dog to go get a beer. This will open it up and pour it into a glass for you. And I assume when it pours it into a glass, it doesn't actually spill over and go everywhere. So it's kind of interesting. This is a Willow Garage PR2 robot. If you don't know about Willow Garage, it was a startup that was a former Google employee, I think, who decided to make this base for a robot. And they have augmented it with a Kinect now. And they've got some different things that they're hoping to have this this robot do for you. One's putting food in the fridge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's, you know, take care of my groceries for me. That's kind of interesting. Two, brush teeth, which I'm good brushing my own teeth. I don't need a robot to brush my teeth. I think I can pretty much handle that. Because if the robot's brushing my teeth, what am I doing? Stand there, what, reading my phone or something? I can handle that. I'll take care of that. Making breakfast cereal. Another one I'm pretty good with, but yeah, it's kind of interesting having a robot do that. And then the other one is pouring a beer. And apparently this robot also plays pool, so it can get you all liquored up and then challenge you to a game of pool, which down below there's a picture of the robot playing pool. Yeah, so, you know, that's pretty interesting.
This just reminds me of, you know, the Jetsons.
Yeah.
Rosie the Robot.
What did Rosie the Robot do? What was her big benefit to the family, other than wisecracking?
Well, that was basically, yeah. You know, give me a wisecracking robot.
Yeah, that'd be good. I'd take that.
Then you got something, but I don't know, one that just gets you a beer?
Yeah.
I mean, meh.
All right, so when they come out with a wisecracking robot, we'll both be on board. But, yeah, I got a feeling my robot would be more like Marvin, the depressed robot who just mumbles around. Yeah. So, yeah, apparently 120 things that they're hoping they can do in the household. The one really interesting thing that I saw here is Science Daily noted that it makes correct predictions 82% of the time when looking 1 second into the future, 71% correct for 3 seconds, and 57% correct for 10 seconds. That's kind of interesting because I hadn't really thought about robots really pondering what would happen in the future. I guess that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But now this is a new equation for Moore's Law, is how far in advance can robots predict the future, which is kind of interesting to me. I mean, I'm trying to think of what things it would do for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would know that when I come home, there's about a 99% chance I'm going to want to flop down on the couch and take a nap. Probably 50-50 whether I do or not. But also, if I come home and the family's out, you mm-hmm. may as well get that Xbox all fired up because, you know, that's my opportunity to play some Xbox and peace and quiet.
So remember, predictions in the future is all about pattern recognition.
Yeah.
Right. So it will still never be able to predict a whim.
Yeah.
No matter how good it gets.
Unless your whim is something that you do predictively.
Predictably, then it's no longer a whim.
Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah.
And where's our free choice now? If we now have robots that can predict our every move,
yeah.
Have we lost our free choice?
Have
we programmed the robots too well?
If we
could program the robots to know our future, then should we not be able to know our own future?
These are all good questions, Go.
I feel existential at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. So we're
gonna beer.
Yeah, we'll sit and think about robots and the future and the loss of free choice and free will. Or maybe we'll gain more free will as the robots take over the stuff we don't want to do and we have free will to do the things we do want to do.
I think they'll tell us what our free will is and we'll bow down to their robotly overlordness.
Wow. All right, so now I really can't wait to get one. I'm so excited about getting a robot master. Yeah, so actually this is, I think what they're aiming for is that you'd be the master and it's gonna get a beer for you. Just keep you drunk so that you don't realize that you're a slave to this robot that's in your house.
Right.
Perfect, all right, well, that happy note, that's the show for this week. If you have questions, you can write us at defragshow@microsoft.com. Leave comments in the show notes, we'll get back to you there, but we like the email so we can go back and forth. See you next week.
Take care.